It's the Trupany Show with your host, James Trupany.
Hello and welcome to the Trupany Show. My name is James Trupany and this is my show. Laying things out there, building a bit of drama. And joining me today is Miss Chelsea Spollen of New York City and Shoulders Up Tech. How are you, ma'am?
Doing okay. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm warm. It is warm this week. There's no other way of putting it but warm.
Oh, we had a bunch of rain and now it's finally nice and sunny outside.
Oh, yeah. Well, it rained all of last week. This week we have rain. We assume this is summer and it'll be autumn next week, so...
Proper English weather.
Yeah, that's it. But this week's show, we're looking at shoot fighting, or more specifically, shoot wrestling, and a couple of companies that started in 1991. As we're looking at the beginner's guide to Japanese wrestling, I thought it would be remiss if we did not look at these two companies and their effect they had on pro wrestling, but quite stylistically, the effect they had on mixed martial arts internationally. Now, our usual expert on this, Sai, is quite appropriately at Super Strong Style 16 this weekend, which is happening in progress is happening in London as we speak. So maybe this is an appropriate time to look at this. And certainly it was an influence on companies like Progress and New Japan Pro Wrestling. Now, we talked a few weeks ago about the UWF, Akira Maeda's organization with Satoru Sayama. And in 1990, the company came to an end. Rather inglorious end, and kind of split into two ways, with the roster splitting off into UWF International and Pro Wrestling Fujiwara Gum. Now, me and Chelsea have been looking at some of this stuff this week to give you an idea of what it's like. Chelsea, what are your impressions of shoot fighting in general in this time period and the way it relates to pro wrestling?
So, it's interesting because shoot fighting that has a predetermined outcome is still... There's only so much of it that really actually is a shoot, but it still has to look like a shoot all the time. Mm. And there's a lot of athleticism and skill that goes into doing a realistic job of having a fight that looks like a fight that's not actually a competition. For me personally, comparing these two products, I felt more at home watching the pro wrestling Fujiwara Gumi because... To me, it felt like a very modern product, especially considering it was filmed in 1991 was the stuff that I watched.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It felt like a pro wrestling product. You know, the wrestlers wore differently colored costumes and there was narrative and commentary. The UWFI, did I get that in the right order?
Yes, yeah, so the Universal Wrestling Force International.
Yes. Which is very, like, a grand-sounding name. UWFI felt to me like a very natural precursor to a lot of the stuff you see in UFC now.
Yeah.
It definitely is a predecessor to it. It doesn't feel quite as modern to me as pro wrestling Fujiwara Gumi, but it was, I mean, like, it's a very logical, like, straight line from that to where we are now.
Yeah, I mean, PWF, let's start with them because that's probably kind of that's the one we're most comfortable and most wrestling of wrestlingy things to us.
Yes.
PWFG was founded by Yoshiaki Fujiwara, who we talked about a couple of weeks ago with Sai and Alex when we were in Manchester, because he appeared on the WWF SWS show that we were talking about then. And Fujiwara is a captivating character as a wrestler. And he was the trainer of Nobuhiko Takada and Akira Maeda in the New Japan Dojo. He was head of the New Japan Dojo. And he went with... originally, he left to go with to help train the UWF guys. Akira Maeda paid an undisclosed sum for Minoru Suzuki, Yoshiaki Fujiwara, and somebody else to be like, oh yeah, Masakatsu Funaki... were all bought out, all their contracts from New Japan were bought out so they could go to the UWF with Akira Maeda. An undisclosed sum.
Interesting.
I have no idea how much that would be to buy three massive superstars of MMA and pro wrestling for the next 20 years, but it may have been some of the best money ever spent in pro wrestling.
Yeah, seriously.
And Fujiwara went to be the chief trainer of UWF. When UWF broke up, he went off and formed his own group, realizing what a draw he'd become himself. you know, he wasn't a great, great draw, but he had saw the opportunity to build himself up, and he actually would parlay this into a solo run in New Japan within the next couple of years. Now, when he left UWF, he took Masakutsu Funaki and Minoru Suzuki with him, and that formed the core genesis of Pro Wrestling Fujiwara Group. Now, UWFI International, by comparison, was headed up by Nobuhiko Takada, who was Akira Maeda's closest friend, and he took a bunch of guys from UWF, like Kazuya Yamazaki, Yoji Angio, Kiyoshi Tamura, Tetsuya Nakano, Masahito Kakihara, and their chief trainer was Billy Robinson, who set up the UWFI Snake Pit. They were going in a slightly different direction, though the basic principles were the same of UWFI and PWFG, which is a set of initials that doesn't roll off the tongue, does it?
Not really.
Now, Takada, Yamazaki, and Anjo were the founders of UWFI International, and as we said, Fujiwara was the founder of PWFG. What they both espoused, much like UWF did, was it was about submissions and knockouts, strikes and submission holds. Pinfalls actually did exist in UWF, but they no longer existed in either of these companies. PWFG relied just straightly on knockouts and submissions, and UWFI would later develop a point system where each wrestler would start with 15 points, and if they had to break the hold by the ropes, they would lose a point, or if they did a foul, they would lose points.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they got knocked down, they would lose points as well. So they were trying to get away from the idea of pinfalls, and this goes back to the old days of the Snake Pit and the Wigan Shooters and the guys who worked in the mine shafts. If you were in a submission grappling match in the north of England in the 19th century, people who were betting on the matches didn't like pinfalls because they're subjective. It depends on how fast the referee's counting. They like submissions because you could say yes or no, that person won or lost.
Right.
And that philosophy bleeds through into this style of wrestling, which I find very interesting. You know, this is where things are starting to get a lot more serious. And as we're starting with Fujiwara Gumi, what was your impressions of the company? I know you give us an outline there. Was there anyone who stood out to you, or was the production anything about the production that stood out to you?
I would say, thinking about it, I don't know that any one particular wrestler stood out to me so much as the production was interesting because it didn't totally fit the mold of anything else I watched from this time period. Mm. Like, most of the wrestling that I've watched from the early 90s is still focused on the idea of pinfalls, and there's a lot more stylized technical wrestling than there was in this. Like, not to say that this isn't stylized. It's still not completely 100% meant to look like a regular fight. But the focus is on, like, there's a lot of very stiff submissions. There's a lot of moves that, if they aren't necessarily something that would actually, you know, do a lot of damage, they're meant to look that way.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's a characteristic of wrestling in general, so I don't know if that's as descriptive as I wanted it to be, but it's, how do I explain? It's very, very stiff. There's a lot of there's a lot of, like, takedowns that look really brutal. There's a lot of, it's not even really selling, because there's guys who are trying to look as tough as possible most of the time, you know?
Yeah.
I don't feel like there's necessarily as much of an emphasis on narrative storytelling.
No, there isn't. It's a lot closer, kind of, like, to sports. I mean, if you look at the next level, which was Pancras, which Funaki and Suzuki were part of.
Right.
Funaki and Suzuki were that good at submissions. They made the entertainment out of the other wrestlers. Like, those two were that far ahead of everybody else when it came to submissions. They would let guys get submission holds on them just to give them a chance to entertain the crowd.
That makes sense.
In real fights, you know, because Pancras, I think they had a couple of book matches at the beginning of their tenure, but up until today, they're a shoot organization. Everything they do is genuine fights. And
right.
This is where they kind of let this kind of started for them. I mean, the UWFI, I'm switching promotions, but they were a lot more shoot orientated, whereas this was more about grappling, wasn't it, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
There was still lots of pro wrestling in there, And then, you know, it also depended on who was fighting. There's certainly a move towards a lot of kicking in PWGFG.
Yes.
That I noticed, because one of the cards I watched, there was a Muay Thai boxing match between a Muay Thai fighter and a wrestler who was obviously clearly influenced by Muay Thai. And that went to a 5-round draw. That was interesting to watch. Because the Muay Thai fighter was clearly terrified of getting in any form of submission hold. So any kicks that he got caught, he just ran to the ropes as quickly as he could on one foot.
I mean, in fairness, you can't 100% blame him. But no. Also, yikes.
Yeah. You're not going to get my leg shredded. And I think that probably would have been a shoot fight as well. Rather than... He's starting to get a mix of what's actually real and what is actually not real. So let's go over to UWFI. What were your impressions of UWFI as far as, and you know, you said this is a lot closer to what UFC would become.
Right.
What makes it that way? What's the important things for you in this promotion?
So UWFI is, it's a less glossy product. Like there aren't really, you don't get the promo packages about the wrestlers in between, and there isn't a lot of commentary, if any commentary at all. It's really, you know, you have a crowd that's very quiet and paying a lot of attention in a very respectful way, and then you have these matches, and the crowd just kind of reacts intermittently, and then the noise dies down. The wrestling itself is very, very stiff and looks a lot more like a real fight. It probably a lot of this actually really hurt.
Yeah.
When I was watching it, they're very rough on each other. But it's not a sports entertainment product, if that makes sense. It's meant to look like a sport.
Yeah.
You watch the matches and you genuinely feel like the two people in them are really trying to kill each other. Or not kill each other, but they're trying to defeat each other physically. Like, who's going to give up first?
Well, I mean, Little Guido, who used to wrestle in ECW in the WWE... he actually had his first major break in UWFI in the early 1990s. He was a dojo guy there.
Really?
Yeah, he was trained by Billy Robinson.
Wow.
Yeah, that's why he got the ECW nickname, the Sicilian Shooter, because he genuinely was a hard case shooter.
And Billy Robinson also trained Marty Jones and Johnny Saint, right?
Yes, he did. And
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I'm trying to think who else there was. New Japan commentator, but on the Access TV shows. Josh Barnett, he taught him more submission than pro wrestling, but I'm sure he would have given him tips on pro wrestling too. Yeah, so, and I was listening to an interview with Guido, and he was on the Art of Wrestling, and he was saying, essentially, everything except the finish was a shoot.
Wow.
But obviously, they're not going out of the way to kill each other, but they are really hitting each other.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like they're trying to kill each other.
Yeah. But, you know, obviously, even if you get too stiff with people and you don't get to the finish, you're going to be in trouble anyway. So you can't get that stiff with people either.
Right.
You know, and this comes down to a lot of things that in Japan, I mean, like, listening to Ted DiBiase talk about his work in Japan, he called it a three-quarter shoot in all Japan pro wrestling. You know, you're laying stuff in as thick as you possibly can. And this was the same thing with UWFI. I think UWFI, the big thing that kind of set itself apart for me was UWFI was always trying to sell itself as being better than all of the wrestling, whereas Fujiwara Gumi just kind of got on with its thing. We'll do what we want to do. Doesn't matter about anybody else. This is our product in our universe, and we're happy to do this. And I think that's what became UWFI's undoing in the end, and why Fujiwara Gumi was as successful as it was. Where the product was kind of dated, but not, and kind of fresh and new, but not, whereas UWFI was something completely new. One thing, I'm watching it now as I came back on it, one thing that I did notice was UWFI had a much bigger impact in the UK and internationally because it had a TV deal that was international.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, UWFI matches were available on Sky on a program called Bushido. And it was that's where I first came into contact with it, you know. In those early days, and one of the biggest cards they did early in their career, I'm sure it was Trevor Burbick, Nobuhiko Takada versus Trevor Burbick, boxer versus fighter, which ended in the end of the first round when Burbick realized he was going to get kicked an awful lot and didn't like it. So, or had a misunderstanding of the rules, and he just left, and there was a riot. And to be honest, that did him more good than you could possibly imagine. No such thing as bad publicity. Yeah, no such thing as bad publicity. People heard about it.
That makes sense.
Yeah, especially as the former World Heavyweight Boxing Champion ran away from Nobuhiko Takada. That's how you could paint it, and that's what they did. So, yeah, it was interesting. But UWFI had this kind of, they were real wrestling, and that certainly was enhanced when Lou Thesz became the commissioner of the UWFI and lent his NWA world title belt from the 1950s to be kind of like their World Heavyweight Championship. And Takada became the first UWFI heavyweight champion. But, you know, they were all about the grandstand challenge. That's what UWFI did, whereas PWFG didn't really mind that much. In fact, they were guests on regular pro wrestling cards, like we discussed last week on SWS. But they kind of kept themselves to themselves even there. SWS guys wrestled SWS guys, and PWFG guys wrestled PWFG guys. So they were kind of off in their own universe, really. And I found that really interesting.
So what you're saying is that, just in general terms of how the company views itself, UWFI is DC, and Pro Wrestling Fujiwara Gumi is Marvel.
Yeah.
Where they kind of don't care what the other guys are doing. They're kind of just, you know, they're going to do it, do their thing, be themselves. They'll get along with other people if they have to. Whereas UWFI are constantly trying to prove themselves as, we're the best, we're the best, we're the best. No, really, we're the best.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, really. Yeah, you know, they had a grandstand challenge to any of the other world champions to face Takada in a shoot fight, you know, which obviously wouldn't work out because the other champions at the time, Misora Misawa, Masahiro Chono, the Great Muta, Hulk Hogan, and Ric Flair, as great as they were, none of them were shooters. Even,
yeah, that would, I can't see that going over well.
No, not really. And no wrestler in their right mind is going to have any fight with a shooter, especially the ones as experienced as all of them. Because they'd go, nope. And also, it doesn't do you any good. The promoters don't like it. This is the reason why pro wrestling is fixed in the first place. They want to control everything. Because controlling things is way easier than not controlling things.
I was going to say it extends the life of the wrestlers and therefore the life of the product in a lot of instances.
Yeah. And
you know, like UFC careers tend to be a lot shorter than WWE careers. Mm-hmm. There's a reason for that.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and also to take into account the stiffness of these matches, UWFI weren't putting on cards very often. You know, they were doing about one card a month. I think PWFG would probably be about the same as well. Because these were like regular MMA fight levels of impact that it was going into the bodies of these wrestlers.
Right.
They couldn't afford to do a two-week tour like New Japan's currently on the Best of Super Juniors tour, and the guys in the BSO Best of Super Juniors matches will be going full tilt for 2 weeks, and then they'll have a week off.
Right.
You know, whereas these guys were going full tilt for 25 minutes, and you could tell how tired they were as well at the end of the matches. You know, I watched one of the matches with Akira Maeda versus Nobuyuki Takada just at the end of UWS run, and I think it probably got the TV deal for UWFI at the time. But they're both absolutely shattered at the end.
Yeah.
And it's because it's really hard wrestling. It's really hard on the body. You know, those kicks are contacting all the time. No one's slapping a leg. That hurts. You know, this is stiff, 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 stiff stuff. So they could only afford to run shows every once in a while, which meant the ticket prices were high because you've got to run this dojo, you've got to do all the promotion, you've got to make the building make money. You know, it's a high investment, low return product as well. You know, this is kind of more tricky to control. Everything it layers into it business-wise is much more tricky to control than, say, a regular wrestling promotion like All Japan and New Japan.
That makes sense. I mean, you know, I watched the matches that I watched two or three, and they were all from 1991. Everybody was totally blown up at the end, just completely exhausted.
Yeah, I mean, you see people take a big sigh and get a second wind and get going. But yeah, but it's kind of difficult to watch as well, because you know that it's like when we watch wrestling, it's like they're there for our entertainment. Well, these guys are there for our entertainment as too, but it's like there's a lot more going on in this. It's kind of wearing down to watch out as well. Maybe not as wearing as the death matches, but certainly, you know, there's a lot of peril involved in these matches too.
it's kind of like the difference between, at least for me, you know, when I watch UFC versus when I watch, like, Bellator or something. When I watch UFC, at least I know that a lot of the times the guy that gets really beat up that loses a tooth that's got blood all over his face at the end is probably getting paid, you know, a couple million dollars that year.
Yeah.
Whereas when I watch Bellator, I just feel really terrible and think, I hope you have a good life insurance policy.
You ain't a big name. You're earning 10 grand for this fight, and that'll have to last you to the rest of your camp. And you have to pay your manager and your corner guy and everybody else.
I was going to say, that's not as much money as it sounds like it is.
Really isn't, you know. There's a film called Play It to the Bone, which is a film about... it stars Antonio Banderas and Woody Harrelson, who are a couple of middleweights who train in California, and they get a fight on a World Heavyweight Championship boxing night, and it's the story of their day as they drive to Vegas for this fight, you know, and the guys in Bellator are those guys, you know, they're the ones that are just earning enough money to make it worthwhile, but not an awful lot more, and they're hoping they get picked up by UFC. You know, but yeah, so, and you know, that's well, we wouldn't be there without these two companies. There is no doubt of that, you know, and especially as, like, when you look at, I think more so with UWFI, that you're right to say it is much more of a precursor of what happens in UFC.
Right.
But the guys in PWFG are the ones who actually were in the original UFC. You know, specifically Ken Shamrock and Bart Vale.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, because Ken Shamrock was a monster back then. You know, he looked just so ripped. He was one of the first guys to have the body type that's very popular now. That Finn Balor, junior heavyweight, lean look. Do you know what I mean?
I do. Shamrock with the killer abs.
Yeah, Shamrock was one of the first guys to look like that. Minoru Suzuki to an extent, but he was softer. Whereas Shamrock was, like, absolutely ripped. And he was an incredible wrestler. I was watching this match with Bart Vale earlier today. And at one point, Shoot takes him over with a Northern Light suplex. And, like, a Northern Light suplex is supposed to be, in pro wrestling circles, you have to rely on your opponent being able to do a forward flip to get it right. Well, he didn't. He just powered him over. And bridged it out. And then when he flipped over on the bridge, he grabbed his leg and heel hooked him. And it was all in one fluid motion.
Wow.
Okay. Now, and we should also, like, really mention about the styles of both these promotions. No holds are undefended. It's not like in a pro wrestling match, a westernized pro wrestling match, where a guy will lay there till you take his arm. They're always defending things like this. So it shows you how worn out Vale was for him to be able to do that. But it looked beautiful. It was so flowing and smooth, you know. And similarly, Minoru Suzuki and Masakata Funaki were just swapping submissions back and forth, and it was reversal after reversal after reversal. It was pure grappling. But even Suzuki was trying to do things like throw drop kicks and do some westernized wrestling stuff. But no one's hitting the ropes. No one's running the ropes. No one's doing anything that you would expect to see in a WWE ring, even at the same time. It's so much of a different product, isn't it?
Yeah. It honestly, at first, trying to watch it for this, I was a little bored. I was like, what is the thing that's missing here? Because it feels like something very big is missing. And then when I really thought about it, I was like, oh, it's just that I'm not accustomed to watching a product that's being presented like this with no frills.
Yeah.
Because that's not how anybody does it anymore.
No. Not even, like, UFC doesn't do it like this. You know?
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, UFC is about substance of a fight, but they're also about flash.
Yeah. And they're trying to build narratives that maybe not there anyway. You know? And it's a victim. I mean, I can put this. Like, even Sports Illustrated do that. Even, like, the big sports magazines and the newspapers want to put a narrative on something because it's easier to sell a story, so it's easier to sell a paper or a magazine.
Right.
And good sports writing has always been about that, way back to Grantland Rice. But, you know, it's much more prevalent now, and UFC is one of those reasons, and pro wrestling is one of those reasons. But this is not like that at all. This is this guy versus this guy. Let's see what happens. You know, and it's striking as well. And even like, because they're watching the early 91 UWFI ones, there's not even Japanese commentary on a lot of their stuff. It's right. Just the matches in front of a crowd. It's your standard blue New Japan style ring. Go. We're not going to tell you what's happening.
Right, there's no context given for any of it, which is, I think, part of why I was confused at first.
Yeah, because even when you're watching like modern Japanese wrestling, the lyrics are the music to the song, aren't they? The commentary is the music to the song, as Jim Ross has quite often said. So even if you don't understand the language, you can still find the beauty of it. It's like opera.
Right.
Where you can't do that with this, because the music is two guys grunting in the ring and shouting in pain.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a much more visceral and direct experience to watching pro wrestling. And I kind of like it sometimes, especially if I'm watching something like JWP or Pure J, as it's known now, because they don't have commentary on any of their matches, never have. That I see as really cool, because it's always flashy, interesting wrestling, and it makes me concentrate on what I'm watching. Whereas this, I would love to have bits more explained.
Yeah, I really needed that too, to be perfectly honest with you. After a while, after watching one match and then starting the next one, I was like, I don't know that I fully understand what I'm watching, and I would like to.
Yeah. Because I think that's the thing. And I think as well, what confuses you about it is, we were talking a couple of weeks ago about Kairi Hojo when she goes to the WWE Women's Tournament, probably we won't using the big elbow off the top rope. Because it was a Bailey move, right? That's what the reason why.
I have a theory about that.
Go on, then.
My theory about that is that they're saying that, but that it's not true. I think they're going to let Kairi do it in whatever her last match is, either before she's like, either she'll make it all the way to the end of the tournament and that'll be her last match, or whatever it is. They'll let her do it once. And after they let her do it once, it'll get so over that they'll have to just keep letting her do it periodically. Because she does a high dive elbow drop, and Bailey does a corkscrew elbow drop where she jumps down.
Yeah.
They're completely different. They don't look anything like one another. I think it's a dumb rumor that WWE maybe started because they wanted to generate some interest.
Yeah.
And I can't see how they're going to take that elbow drop off the table. It's so over, and Kairi loves doing it, and it's so easy for her to do.
Yeah. But going back to my point.
Yes.
But yes,
I'm sorry.
I completely agree with you. But going back to my point was, you get that move separation. Everyone's gimmick is protected. There is a move set for Seth Rollins. There is a move set for Dean Ambrose. There is a move set for whoever you are, wherever you are in one thing.
Yes. Randy Orton's the only one allowed to do a jumping cutter.
Yeah. So you get this separation, and it makes characters easier to connect to. Whereas when you're watching this, everyone kicks people in the face. Everyone uses open hand slaps. Everyone uses heel hooks. Everyone uses leg bars. Everyone uses a cross arm breaker. Everyone uses a cross face.
Absolutely.
And that, because that's the bread and butter basic maneuvers of shoot fighting if you are a shoot fighter. You see guys spending 2 or 3 minutes working on getting a key lock in. Which is like, from a wrestling entertainment point of view, is really boring.
Yup.
But from a shoot fighter's point of view, is a very sensible thing to do. Because if he can't move his arm, he can't hit you very hard.
Yup.
Yeah, so there is a lot of psychology that really could do with being explained to the people who are watching it. Not in a, you know, from a booked wrestling point of view, shooty way. What I mean is, from the way that Joey Styles or Jim Ross explains with pure sensible beauty how a wrestling match works from the storyteller's point of view, you could do with some of that here.
Yes, for sure.
You know, it's not the easiest thing in the world to follow. Like most Japanese wrestling, you can see the point.
Yes.
But it's not as easily accessible as all Japan or New Japan of the same time period, I would say.
Was there a little bit of an implication there that Japanese wrestling is better at showing you what the point is than other kinds of wrestling?
Would you suggest I'd say such a thing, Chelsea?
I don't know.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I'm going to say that, yeah. Yeah. And it's, well, I'm just saying that just because it seems to me, when having watched as much Japanese wrestling as I have done, And don't get me wrong, there are simple forms of wrestling from all around the world that you're easily relatable to. If you go watch Southern wrestling from the 70s and 80s, within 2 minutes you know exactly what's going on. You can watch it with the sound off and know what's happening because the bad guys have angry faces and the good guys are smiling, and you know that's the way it's supposed to be. You know.
Yes.
But from an in-ring story point of view, Japanese wrestling does it so well because everything is the build of the narrative within the match. The limited ideas of what promos should be and how promos work have enhanced this storytelling ability within the wrestlers. And, you know, that's not to say there isn't great pro wrestling anywhere else in the world. It's just what I've grown used to and what is... I think when I was a kid, I had this idea of what a home promotion was, the promotion you watched all the time. And if no other people talk about it as well. As in WWE, be your home promotion because that's what got you into the business and that's what you watch.
Yeah, that's probably
true.
And
I guess my home promotion now really is New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Mm.
But for a long time, it was WCW, and before that, it was British wrestling. You know, so I think
that, I can see that.
I think you get that used to the tropes and the ideas that you see things a lot deeper because they just recycle ideas. All wrestling companies have to because there's only so many stories to tell.
Oh, yeah,
and
for sure.
I think when you come to this stuff, which is taking that element out, but they still have to entertain. They still have to make you want to watch.
Right.
You know, but it's based on something that's completely different. But I still understand it in that basic core element, because these are all New Japan guys. In both dojos, essentially, it is New Japan guys who are doing the work.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's not... These guys don't come from all Japan. Because that King's Road style doesn't translate to this, does it?
You know, it's interesting. I hadn't consciously thought about that until you just said it, but that, you know, now that you said it, I'm like, absolutely, 100%.
Yeah, because King's Road is all about regular pro wrestling, American-style pro wrestling moves done big.
Right.
Whereas this is about making things look as realistic as possible.
Right, so a lot of the most athletic feats in these matches are relatively very small-looking by comparison, even though it's not a small feat of athleticism.
So Shamrock's forced Northern Lights suplex into a leg bar suddenly becomes 10 times more important.
Yeah.
Because they're doing that little in the rest of the match. They're doing lots, but it's all small stuff. It's thinking, like, it's getting your mindset to thinking smaller and how can we do this to make it, like, as realistic as possible and put the drama into what you're doing hold for hold rather than what you're doing throughout the story of the match.
Right.
I mean, we talk a lot today about, like, the flippy guys and stuff. But this was this was just as revolutionary, but going in the opposite direction. This was, you know, this was making other wrestling look silly for having all those flips and dives because they're doing it so basically ground down to what the fundamentals are.
I guess, but it made me miss the flips and dives. For whatever that's worth. And I mean, some of that is just, that's just my personal taste. I like a lot of that stuff when it's done really well. But I mean, I was watching this and thinking a lot of this looks really flat by comparison. Like,
yeah.
If you had just one guy who did a shooting star press, it would really make a splash.
It does interest me as like, as well, like, if you flip it around the other way, the guys who are involved in this have become massive stars as well.
Mm.
You know, Masakitsu Funaki had a big run in Wrestle 1. He had a big run in New Japan Pro Wrestling in the early 2000s. He was obviously a massive star for Pancras as a shoot fighter. Minoru Suzuki had a big run as a shoot fighter in Pancras. Then he went to Noah. Then he went to All Japan. Then he went back to Noah. Then he went to New Japan. And as we know now, he is still one of the biggest stars in the industry at the age of 47.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Ken Shamrock obviously went to UFC, but then went back to the WWF and became a massive star there. Going into UWFI, Nobuyuki Takada was a massive draw for UWFI up until the mid-90s. Then he became a big draw for New Japan Pro Wrestling. Ended up in Hustle and was one of the characters in Hustle, which is hilarious, and we'll look at that later in when we get later in the decade, because like the most austere pro wrestler of all time becomes a massive comedy character.
You know, they say that the more that a character is supposed to be like a straight man, the funnier that comedy bits actually become when you introduce them.
Yeah, that's true. Yoshihiro Takayama was another one. Yoshihiro Takayama may run Akira Hokuto for the toughest person I've ever come across in wrestling award.
Yeah?
Yeah. Takayama is... He's 6'6", I think. What's his height? He's 6'5". He's 276 pounds. Despite being 50 years old, he still wrestles regularly on a daily basis today, despite having a pretty heavy-duty stroke about 15 years ago.
Wow.
He left UWFI and became an MMA fighter, and he fought Don Fry in Pride and went the full distance and took an absolute beating and was in every submission hold you could think of and refused to give up for the whole fight.
Wow.
Takayama, he got the upper hand a little bit, and basically neither of them would give up for the whole fight. Takayama just stood there and took it for the full fight. It was ridiculous. After that
sounds pretty crazy.
Yeah. After that, he went to All Japan Pro Wrestling, and he went to New Japan Pro Wrestling, and then he went back to All Japan. He's been around all over. Journeyman guy. I don't think he ever won the IWGP Heavyweight Championship, but he definitely challenged for it at Wrestle Kingdom one year. His big running buddy with Minoru Suzuki as well, because they both come from they came from the New Japan Dojo at the same time. You know, and Funaki's New Japan Dojo buddies were like Jushin Liger and it was Jushin Liger, Muto, Chono, Chris Benoit. It's just like a list of the entire like 2000s and early 90s and 2000s New Japan roster. Funaki was one of those guys. You know, if he'd stayed put, he could have done incredible things for New Japan Pro Wrestling, but he didn't feel he was getting anywhere, and he moved on to UWF and then on to PWFG. This is another thing we come across with Japanese wrestling. The guys that don't feel they're getting the credit for what they deserve, tend to go off and do different things. And this is one of the reasons why you have such...
Not just the guys, the women too.
Yeah, yeah. You wouldn't get that in the States. Like, I don't know, Ethan Carter III thinking, I'm feeling undervalued at TNA. I'm going to break off and start my own promotion. That doesn't happen.
Well, I don't know that I necessarily 100% agree. Because, like, I think of Michael Elgin left Ring of Honor and started his own promotion that's been very successful.
Yeah.
But I think that the promotions that get started don't necessarily receive the level of media coverage that the bigger guys do. So they may be happening, we're just not aware of them.
I think as well, in both these promotions were started in Tokyo. UWFI had its first show at Kurikan. PWFG had its first show at Tokyo Hall. So, you know, in Tokyo, if you are big in Tokyo, you're pretty much going to be big everywhere in Japan. That's unfair to say, but, you know, there is kind of like Tokyo as a size of a market in relation to the rest of the country is much bigger than one city, any city in the United States of America, especially now, because back then if you penetrated, you had much more greater chance of success, whereas now you got less likely to penetrate because there's so much more competition for your time, not just in wrestling, but everything. And it's harder to get the penetration, I think. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you know,
I do.
Yeah, so if you start a wrestling company in Lexington, Kentucky, it might be awesome in Lexington, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to get anywhere else.
Right, and part of that is that anybody who doesn't live there is probably not going to drive 6 hours to get there, whereas... Mm. I mean, the wrestlers who wrestle for New Japan Pro are usually close enough to the event that a lot of them get to sleep in their own beds pretty much every night when they're performing in Japan.
Yes.
Because it's just a smaller area to cover.
Plus you have that wonderful train system.
Yes.
That means that you can get anywhere you want to within the day. You don't have to fly, you don't have to take planes. You'll be there within a couple of hours. guaranteed.
Yep, fastest bullet trains are a lot faster than driving.
Yeah, so, you know, that I think that's one of the reasons why you get so much more experimentation in Japanese wrestling rather than anything else, is just because the ability to experiment. You look at FMW, you know, their big arena shows were in Kawasaki, because it's a bullet train ride away from Tokyo. They could get the people of Kawasaki and ship people in from Tokyo, and it wasn't that much of a seen that big as a difficulty. And I think that kind of reflects in this. You've got so much that's so different, but equally that basic business principle of create a watchable product and people will come and see it.
Yeah.
Now, we kind of will probably talk a little bit more about these two groups as we go through reviewing the years when we find something really, really interesting. But I kind of wanted to give you a kind of historic roundup of these two companies so we could cover shoot style wrestling in general. We'll start with PWFG. There was no real championships in PWFG. It was just kind of like 4 years of guys wrestling other guys.
Which is kind of flat, narratively.
Yeah. And eventually, Fujiwara kind of got onto this kick about Lucha Libre and started getting away from the shoot fighting aesthetic that they were after. You know, he was trying to do something that was much more kind of lucha-based, but they were trying to get something together that was much more realistic. And eventually, they all quit the promotion and started the promotion called Pancras. Now, like we said earlier, Pancras started out as a bit of a wrestling promotion, but under the direction of their trainer, who ended up being Carl Gotch, he suggested that they actually have proper wrestling matches under shoot-fight rules. And again, they in 1993, they promote their first again, which is again at Tokyo Bay NK Hall, which is where Fujiwara Gum started. So they obviously took a lot of their connections with them. And that became the shoot fighting championships of Pancras, which is still running today. They have a women's division now. Shiori, a famous Joshi wrestler, she fights for them when she isn't pro wrestling.
And she's awesome.
She's amazing. Some of the best kicks in wrestling. It's fantastic. But the Pancras kind of style was based on the same thing as PWFG was and UWF before it, which was a style that was purely sporting. There was no pinfalls, it was just knockouts and submissions to decide a winner. And it made some big stars. Ken Shamrock was chosen to go to the early Ultimate Fighting Championships, and then went on to a WWE career. So Pancras was kind of interesting, and UWFI had a similar demise. In the early days, it made a lot of money with these dream matches that Takada tried to put together with his own roster. And then eventually, he invited Big Van Vader over to Japan, who was the only long-term champion around at the time who was willing to go to UWFI after he kind of run out of things to do in New Japan Pro Wrestling.
He was Super Vader.
Yes,
there,
he was. Because they weren't allowed to use the words Big Van, because that's a New Japan copyright. Yeah, it was designed by New Japan Pro Wrestling. The character was designed before they picked the wrestler for it.
Really?
Do you know who was likely to be the other person in the running?
No.
I think we've talked about this before on the podcast. The two choices for Big Van Vader were Leon White and Jim Helwig, who became the Ultimate Warrior.
Wow. I can't imagine that.
No,
I'm trying to imagine the Ultimate Warrior in the Big Van Vader, like the
mask.
The mask and the costume, and yeah, it's strange.
It is, but no, it didn't happen, in fact, thankfully. But eventually, Vader ended up in UWFI and had some great success as a draw against Takada. He defeated Takada for Thez's World's Championship, which Lou didn't like because Vader wasn't a shooter, and he wasn't in that shoot style, so he actually withdrew the championship, and that's when the credibility started to fall apart for UWFI. And eventually, they suggested they have a major feud with New Japan Pro Wrestling. And New Japan went, yeah, we'll do that, as long as we get to book everything.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not surprising they would feel that way.
No, especially after UWFI had been on television for the previous 2 years saying that New Japan's fake. Which is
a criticism that... for somebody in the wrestling industry to have that criticism of another wrestling promotion is just hilarious to me.
It is, especially when, you know, UWFI was not a shoot product. It was a shoot style product. There was plenty of shooting going on, but it wasn't hook 'em holds for a finish. It wasn't not predetermined. The person who was going to win was going to win.
Right. You know,
so it was, yes, it was a more advanced form or an older form, really, of pro wrestling, but it was still, you know, it wasn't a shoot fight. So, yeah, and as you can imagine, Fez wasn't happy about it. Neither was Danny Hodge, who'd have come in and done a couple of demonstrations for them as well. So, yeah, after that feud, which we'll talk about, I'll not spoil too much because we'll definitely talk about those cards because they're on New Japan World. If you want to go have a look at them, we will definitely look at them when we get to 1985 because they were fascinating and some of the best matches I've ever seen as well. You can't believe a guy like
Takada. High praise.
Yeah, Takada, just the crowds were absolutely amped for them. And Takada really pulls everything out, you know. And also, he's a former New Japan guy as well. I think he kind of wanted to impress. You know,
maybe just a little.
Just a little. And it was his style on the line as well. You know, there's so much going on. It's power politics in pro wrestling, those cards. And I would point out, they sold out the Tokyo Dome 4 times with Takada as champion in the space of a year.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it was well worth it for the business and showed you how big they became in this time period. And maybe the lasting legacy of these groups is, I look at people like Jack Gallagher and Zack Sabre Jr. and Marty Scurll, who are really taking that older British wrestling style. But if it wasn't for companies like UWFI and PWFG, that style would never have continued anyway. They were the ones for holding the flame for that British snake pit driven style well into the 1990s when British wrestling was kind of dying.
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that before. But, I mean, I can absolutely see the continuity between this and those guys you just mentioned, for sure.
Yeah, because, I mean, to me, it's like, having been an observer for a long time now, far too long because I'm old, you look back at that 80s style, and when you look at the British independent scene after TV time ended and All Star starts reducing itself, there was kind of an anti-British wrestling scene within the British wrestling scene. The older style wasn't as fondly remembered.
Mm.
You know, it was all about, we've got to do things in a kind of wild and crazy ECW style to grab attention. And then it became, well, we need to be more realistic like Ring of Honor, not realizing that Ring of Honor had borrowed its style from Japan, who'd borrowed its style from Britain. You know.
Which is interesting because the Ring of Honor style is definitely compatible with both of those things, but has become something separate.
Yeah, it's evolved over a 10-15 year period.
Right.
But there was, as with anything, when you're trying to get something big, you tend to be slavishly copyish. You know, there was a certain backlash against that British sense of wrestling for a long time. And it wasn't until Zack Sabre Jr. that continuity came back again, you know, because it's associated, it had negative connotations with Big Daly and Giant A-Stacks. But I did an interview mm-hmm. with Jetta recently, a British wrestler, who said herself, I'm not the greatest worker in the world, but I know how to make a crowd pop because I can talk to them. And she shouts through a crowd, and it came down from the fact she was doing the old shall I routines of British wrestlings on the Seaside Circuit for Brian Dixon and All Star. And then she went,
that's really interesting.
And then as a heel, she was going, well, hang on, if I do this at the cool wrestling shows in the cities, they'll hate me.
Right.
And it was like, it took people like her to realize, to move the business on, we have to take some steps back. You know, and certainly I think there is a lot of that going on here. You see Jack Gallagher doing a lot of this stuff that happened in UWFI, and certainly that happened in Pancras, and Pro Wrestling Fujiwaragumi. So it's, yeah, it's kind of like holding that flame for the snake pit and that British style of wrestling together, because
that's really interesting.
Yeah, because it didn't really exist. It didn't really have anyone keeping the flame together back here.
Mm.
But that's, you know, that's my impressions of it, and that's what I've been thinking as I've been watching these, really. Have you got anything else you'd like to say about these two companies, Chelsea?
I would say that It's interesting to watch, but for my personal taste, I don't know if it's enough of a modern product for me to necessarily get it. That doesn't mean that there isn't stuff there that I can enjoy. It just means that I don't know that I would have immediately been able to understand it without, or I didn't immediately understand it without all the context that you provided. Now that you've explained it, I get it a lot better.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Made me sound really clever.
As is so frequently the case when I do these podcasts with you, James, I watch something and then I'm like, oh, that's what that is. Okay.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's interesting stuff to watch. It's not something you want to pop in the DVD every week.
No.
But it is something well worth watching should you be drawn to guys like Jack Gallagher and Marty Scurll and Zack Sabre Jr. and a lot.
I mean, really, and if you can't get behind one or all three of those guys, what are you doing listening to this podcast? Like, come on.
Yeah, because they're the kind of guys that were inspired by the kind of guys I like and the kind of guys you like, Chelsea. And, you know, this style really is important to that. You know, and Minoru Suzuki is still a god of professional wrestling in this day and age.
Still just one of the best.
Yes, and I did invite Emily Reed on here just for her to say, Minoru Suzuki is awesome, and that's all she had to say, but she didn't quite have time today. She would have liked to have done that.
That's okay. We can fit that in a later episode.
Yes, we can do. But yeah, Minoru Suzuki, it's well worth watching his growth. And you see, because he doesn't really change his wrestling style from 1991 to 2017. He just gets better at it and adapts it to the field he's in much better. You know, it's still leg bars and heel hooks, just as it was back then. And he even manages a pile driver in a shoot match.
Wow.
Which is just awesome. Because all of a sudden a pile driver is really, really important. Funaki no sells it, but that's not the point.
Right.
So, yeah, it's interesting and fascinating stuff to watch. So we strongly recommend you find some. There's loads all over YouTube. Because, funnily enough, it's MMA fans who keep the flame for this stuff going, not necessarily wrestling fans. You know, and because a lot of these guys ended up in MMA, the MMA fans wanted to know where they came from. So there's lots of videos around on YouTube. So thank you very much for listening to The Troopany Show today. I hope you've enjoyed our little chat about shoot fighting and really aggressive men from Japan. And in fact, all around the world. I'd like to thank my guest for today, Chelsea Spollen. I appreciate your work today, ma'am.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
And you can follow her at Chelsea Comics on Twitter and also shoulders_up, where she handles all the wrestling news that is fit to tweet about in North American wrestling.
I try.
Yeah. You can follow me at Sheriff Lone Star on Twitter as well. And you can follow WrestleTalk at WrestleTalk_TV. I haven't plugged that Twitter handle in a while. I thought I should. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us on SoundCloud and all your favorite podcast providers. Please do go and give us a review. Especially on iTunes. It'd be nice to see some new ones. We haven't seen any in a while. Thank you very much for listening today. You can also listen to Gavin and Ben. Get it right. I silly said Gavin and Paul. Gavin and Ben on the WrestleTalk TV, The Squash. And you can catch up with Ollie Davis and all the stuff he puts on the YouTube channel for free of charge as well. Thank you very much for your time today. Take care, and we'll speak to you next week. Bye.